But without any more ado, it's my privilege to introduce our speaker this evening, who is Michael Ward. Now, I first met Michael when he came for interview at the college in Oxford where I was teaching. I interviewed him and he chose not to come. Not sure what that says about my interviewing technique, but he ended up in Cambridge instead. But he's been a very good friend to many of us here in the college for a number of years. And he is a really very interesting person. He is, this is the words of Tom Wright, who many of you will know, the foremost living scholar of C.S. Lewis. That you could go anywhere in the world to find someone who knows, you wouldn't find many people who know more about C.S. Lewis and who've done more interesting and innovative thinking on Lewis's work than Michael. So it's a real privilege to have him with us this evening. He's the author of a book called Planet Narnia, The Seven Heavens in the Imagination of C.S. Lewis, which was published by OUP. You can buy it on Amazon. It was a fascinating book, and he'll be talking about the book this evening, which gave a whole new window into what was going on in Lewis's mind when he was writing these stories that seem on the surface very simple and childish stories, but actually there's an awful lot more going on under the surface, and Michael will be speaking about that as well. He, on the back of that book, he presented a BBC One television documentary called The Narnia Code. And he speaks all over the world on Lewis and is in great demand. He's just come back from Madrid, he tells me, yesterday, where he was speaking there last year, 2013, 50th anniversary of Lewis's death, was hugely in demand across the world speaking about C.S. Lewis. Not just on C.S. Lewis, also on J.R.R. Tolkien, the Inklings, that little group of intellectuals, Christian intellectuals who were in Oxford at the time that Lewis was there. And he writes and thinks a great deal about the theological imagination as well. He's a senior research fellow at Blackfriars Hall in Oxford, and he's also professor of apologetics at Houston Baptist University in Texas. And you can't do that thing these days, do a job in America and a job in England. Anyway, we're delighted to have Michael with us this evening, and without any more delay, please give a very warm welcome to Michael Ward.
Oh, yes. The heavens are telling the glory of God. The firmament proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours forth speech. Night to night declares knowledge. There's no speech, nor are there words, their voice is not heard. Yet their voice goes out through all the earth, and their words to the ends of the world. Those are the opening verses of Psalm 19, which St. Paul quotes in Romans 10, where he's talking about whether the Gentiles have heard the word of Christ. And he says, yes, they have heard, for their voice has gone out through all the earth and their words to the ends of the world. Paul seems to equate somehow the silent word of the heavens with the word of Christ itself. Now, C.S. Lewis was very interested in the heavens. Here he is pictured on the cover of Time magazine in the 1940s, just after he published the Screwtape Letters. That's why he's got the devil and the angel either side of his head. And C.S. Lewis was fascinated by the heavens in very many different ways. And it's about his interest in the heavens and the theological significance and symbolism of the heavens that I want to talk to you tonight, and in particular how I believe he wove the imagery of the seven heavens into the books for which he's best known, the Seven Chronicles of Narnia. Here he is. I can't see this. I can't see what the next slide is going to be, so I'll have to do a lot of twisting around. Here they are, the Seven Chronicles of Narnia. Now, Graham asked you a moment ago how many of you had read the Narnia Chronicles, and I was surprised about how few people put up their hands. I don't think you were really listening to the question. So let me ask it again. How many people here have read at least one of these books or seen at least one of the movies? That's more like it. Okay, now who didn't put up their hand? Well, you might want to leave now. Hopefully this won't be too boring for you, but, well, that's pretty impressive. That almost everybody in this room has some familiarity with these books or some familiarity with the films that have been made from the books. That's impressive. There aren't that many series of books that you could ask that question about and get such a positive response to. These are some of the best-selling and most influential books of the last 60 years. And still today, they're selling, I believe, about 3 million copies annually worldwide in over 40 different languages. I wonder if you've ever sat back from your enjoyment of these seven books and asked yourself why C.S. Lewis wrote them the way that he did. It's not particularly obvious why he structured them in the way that he did, because, as his great friend Tolkien said, on the surface level, on the level of the literary components to these tales, they look a bit of a hodgepodge. Lewis read aloud the first few chapters of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe to Tolkien, and Tolkien hated what he heard. And I don't overestimate that. He strongly detested the way Lewis assembled these stories out of what he considered to be incompatible mythological traditions. English children who seem to have stepped out of the pages of an E. Nesbitt book. Centaurs, fauns, naiads and dryads out of Greek and Roman mythology. A white witch who seems to be very closely based on the Snow Queen in a Hans Andersen fairy tale. Father Christmas, for goodness sake. What's he doing in the story? Now, Tolkien thought this wasn't a pleasing sort of catch-all approach. It was evidence of imaginative confusion. And if you know Tolkien's Middle Earth, The Lord of the Rings, you all know how Tolkien's imagined subcreated world is refined to the last degree of perfection. Tolkien was a purist and a perfectionist, inventing languages and genealogies and who knows what. He published The Lord of the Rings with, I think, 7 appendices. So you can imagine why Tolkien didn't much like what seemed to be the mishmash of the first few chapters of the first of these 7 books. But he so disliked what he heard that he soon gave up trying to read the books, and he later confessed they were entirely outside his range of imaginative sympathy. Which was a polite way of saying he thought they were rubbish. He didn't think they were rubbish. He did give them to his grandchildren, and he thought they were worth reading. It's just he didn't like them. But he had very narrow tastes. Anything later than Shakespeare was too modern for Tolkien. Anyway, Tolkien's attitude on the surface has something going for it, because the books don't seem to have been composed with any very obvious imaginative logic. And yet, if you know anything about C.S. Lewis's characteristic habits of mind, you know that he wasn't an inconsistent or an illogical writer or thinker. He was a very rigorous and consistent thinker. One of his friends once said that what Lewis thought about everything was somehow secretly present in what he said about anything. If you know Lewis's poetry is fantastically complex. I mean, mind-bogglingly complex. Lewis himself said that he was enamored of metrical and phonetic subtleties, and the poems which look as if they're in free verse are often in the most complicated meters of all. As a literary scholar, Lewis loved studying the writings of medieval and Renaissance authors who, he said, loved to present us with something which can't be taken in at a glance. Everything leads to everything else in these authors, but often by very intricate paths. Complexity, he said, is a mark of the medieval mind. And then as a Christian, too, Lewis believed that the universe itself is a fantastically intricate work of divine artistry. Every single thing in creation, he said, has been made both for its own sake and for interdependent purposes with every other created thing. We may not be able to see very easily what those purposes are, but Lewis believed that they existed in the mind of God, the Creator. Even seemingly random things have been made for a purpose down to the curve of every wave and the flight of every insect, he says in his book on prayer. Now, bearing those things in mind, it's not very likely that Lewis would have slopped the Narnia books together without much care or forethought. I mean, if they really were a random hodgepodge, that would be entirely uncharacteristic of him. And most readers and scholars of Lewis aren't prepared to say they're just random. But in looking for some more kind of logical consistency and coherence to the books, they go looking at the obvious biblical parallels within the series. Lewis once said that the whole Narnia series is about Christ. And the Christ character, Aslan, the Lion King, is the only character who appears in all seven books. So that looks on the surface like it might be the answer to this riddle. The only problem is that Aslan is only really very obviously Christ-like in these three books. We have Aslan as the Redeemer in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, Aslan as Creator in The Magician's Nephew, Aslan as the Judge in The Last Battle. And the biblical parallels in those three stories are all well and good, very obvious, you can't miss them. But those are only three out of seven books. What about the other four? In these four, Aslan is still present, yes, he's still Christ-like in various ways. He teaches people, he guides people, he forgives people. But there's no major episode or element of Christ's life or ministry that's being reimagined in these four books. I mean, you might have expected Lewis to give us a whole Narnia story devoted to the birth of Aslan, a nativity story. Aslan being born into Narnia as a lion cub, like Jesus is born as a baby into Bethlehem. You don't get that. You don't get a Narnian ascension account. You don't get a Narnian Pentecost. Why not, given what Lewis has done in these three? What do you get in these four books? You get Aslan entering the story in Prince Caspian amongst dancing trees before giving a great war cry. In The Dawn Treader, you have Aslan flying in a sunbeam. In The Silver Chair, Aslan doesn't actually come down to Narnia at all. He's confined to his own high country above the clouds, and that looks much more like an Old Testament understanding of God. Not the incarnate Christ, but the pre-incarnate Christ. And then in The Horse and His Boy, Aslan's mistaken for two lions, or maybe three lions, and he does a great deal of dashing about in that story. You remember he says there was only one lion, but he was swift of foot. So why would you make your Christ character swift of foot? I don't recall Jesus in the Gospels having a special ministry to athletes or being a notable sprinter. Why would you do that? So when we look at the Chronicles from the point of view of the obvious biblical parallels, they don't seem to hang together very much better than they do when you consider them just at the level of the simple story. And yet we still have this problem that Lewis is so fascinated by intricacy and complexity. So this has caused Lewis scholars and critics to go looking for a third level of significance that might tie the series together a bit more satisfactorily. And all sorts of different theories have been suggested, most of them not very seriously. The seven deadly sins, for instance. Perhaps that's the governing theme. Two critics, independently of each other, came up with that idea. The only problem is they assigned different sins to different books. So that idea never got going. Another critic suggested that the books are based on the seven Catholic sacraments, overlooking the fact that Lewis wasn't a Catholic. He was an Anglican, and of course in Anglicanism there are two sacraments, not seven. So we can dismiss that idea. All sorts of other theories have been suggested. The seven virtues, the seven books of Spenser's Faerie Queen, the seven dwarfs, I don't know, probably someone's come up with that at some PhD in California, I don't know. No, I'm only joking. And I must criticize myself, because I once made a half-hearted attempt to link the Chronicles to different plays by Shakespeare. But I soon abandoned that idea. You know when you're trying to twist books to fit a grid of your own devising, and that idea never got very far. It was when I wasn't looking for it that I believe I stumbled across the real answer to this imaginative puzzle that the Narnia books present. It was quite the most exciting thing that has happened to me while holding a book in my hands. I was halfway through my PhD at the time. The reason I didn't go and study under Graham in Oxford had nothing to do with Graham. It's because I wanted to go to Cambridge to study under Jeremy Begbie. And Jeremy Begbie was my PhD supervisor. So, Graham, don't take it personally, please. Halfway through my PhD research on C.S. Lewis, I had an idea, and it's that idea that I want to share with you tonight. I told my idea to my supervisor, and he said you should write up the book, write up the account, and it later came out as this book, which Graham mentioned. Graham also mentioned that the BBC then got interested and commissioned a TV documentary about it, The Narnia Code, which some of you may have seen a few years ago. There's now a book of the same title, which is a much shorter and simpler version of Planet Narnia. So if you want to know anything more about what I've said tonight, the place to go is these two books and the associated website. Because we've only got about 45 minutes to cram in the whole of the substance of this claim, this discovery, if that is what it is. I'll leave you to adjudicate that. Because on the basis, what I'm going to argue is a very bold, you might even say an arrogant claim, that Lewis had a secret plan to the Narnia books that he told nobody about and that nobody noticed for 50-odd years and which I suddenly have discovered. I mean, you can't get much more arrogant than that. And if I would be skeptical if anybody came to me with such a claim. However, when you begin to look at the evidence, it begins to stack up in surprising ways. And if this theory is right, it shows that these books are far more interesting and far more Christian than we've previously realized them to be. But it is a bold claim, and you'd be right to be skeptical. So before I come on actually to the substance of the argument itself, let me give you five quick background reasons as to why this is not only something that could be possible for Lewis to do, but really why it is something that it is probable that he did do. It's not such an outlandish claim when we have in place certain background considerations. So five quick background reasons. The first of them has to do with Lewis's own personality. Lewis could be quite secretive when he wanted to be. George Sayer, who knew C.S. Lewis for 30 years, wrote a very good biography of him called Jack, C.S. Lewis, His Life and Times. You know, don't you, that Jack was Lewis's nickname. He didn't like the name Clive, let alone the name Staples. So he was always known as Jack. And George Sayer says in that biography that Jack never ceased to be secretive. Jack never ceased to be secretive. And if we're looking for examples of his secretiveness, the most obvious example is the fact that when he got married in his late 50s, he kept his marriage secret for the best part of a year. Have you seen the film Shadowlands? Do you know about this aspect of Lewis's biography? It's the most extraordinary thing to do. He got married and told nobody, not even close friends like Tolkien, for the best part of a year. A man who can keep his marriage secret can keep anything secret. That's not the only example that comes to mind. I mean, his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, left out so many really important things that one of his friends jokingly said it should not have been called Surprised by Joy. It should have been called Suppressed by Jack. So he could be secretive. Of course, I'm not claiming that because he's secretive in these other areas that therefore Narnia has a secret. I'm not arguing that, I'm just saying this is the kind of man we're dealing with. Temperamentally, psychologically, he was very well able to keep secrets, even major secrets, when he wanted to, when he saw that he had good reason. So that's the psychological background point. Now, an epistemological background point. Epistemology is the study of how we know things, the science of consciousness. And Lewis once said that an influence which can't evade our consciousness won't go very deep. An influence which can't evade our consciousness won't go very deep. He meant two things by consciousness. He divides consciousness into contemplation and enjoyment. And he writes about these in a little article called Meditation in a Toolshed, where he pictures himself standing in the darkness of a toolshed one sunny day. It's dark inside, but it's bright outside this shed, and through a crack at the top of the door, he can see a beam of light. Slants down through the darkness of the shed. He can see little particles of dust floating in the beam. It lights up a patch of the floor. And this is his image of one particular kind of consciousness, which he calls contemplation. Looking at something from the outside. Inspecting it from a distance. In a kind of neutral, objective point of view. That's one way in which we know things. He then shifts his position so that the beam of light is no longer falling on the floor, but is now falling directly on his eyes. And instantly, he said, the whole picture changed. He no longer saw the tool shed, and above all, he no longer even saw the beam of light, because he now saw along the beam of light. And what he saw along it was something quite different. He saw the crack at the top of the door, the leaves on the tree waving in the wind outside, millions of miles away the sun itself. And this is his image of the second kind of consciousness, which he calls enjoyment, looking along the beam. This is the sort of knowledge of something that we have when we're committed to it. We inhabit it. We let it embrace us. If you know French, this distinction is very like the distinction in French between savoir and connaître knowledge. And Lewis says that we should really try out every question that presents itself to us in both modes of consciousness, insofar as we can. He says we should be like the ancient Persians, who debated everything twice, once when they were sober and once when they were drunk. There are benefits to our knowledge of being drunk. I mean, not literally, but metaphorically. Because when you're drunk, you are immersed in the thing. You are embraced. Your inhibitions are down. When you step inside the beam. But the interesting thing is that when you step inside the beam vanishes. Because it's no longer the object of your vision. It's now the medium of your vision. Light is not something we see, it is something we see by, Lewis says. So when he says that an influence which can't evade our consciousness won't go very deep, what he means is an influence which can't evade our contemplative consciousness won't go very deep. For as long as we're just contemplating things, looking at them from a distance, they won't go deep with us. They need to get beneath the radar of our contemplative consciousness and sink down into enjoyment consciousness for us to know them from within, to have a sort of personal knowledge of them. But the interesting thing is, the personal knowing involves a kind of invisibility. A beam vanishes when you look along it. That's the epistemological background point. Now a theological background point. Lewis was interested in this verse from Colossians. For all things were created through Christ and for Christ, and in Christ all things hold together. Lewis was sufficiently interested in this verse to paraphrase it in one of his books. He paraphrases it as, Christ is the all-pervasive principle of cohesion, whereby the universe holds together. The all-pervasive principle of cohesion. That's Lewis's description of Christ. An all-pervasive principle of cohesion. Now, if this is true, it means that our very understanding of Christ is itself held together by and in and for Christ. We can't, in that sense, step outside Christ and look back at him as if from some external spectator's point of view. To do that would be to cease to exist. because all things hold together in Christ. No thing does not hold together in Christ. But this puts us into something of a predicament, which Lewis writes about in his book Miracles. He says, the fact which is in one respect the most obvious and primary fact, that is to say, God, Christ, the fact which is in one respect the most obvious and primary fact, and through which alone you have access to all the other facts, may be the one that is most easily forgotten. Forgotten not because it's so remote or abstruse, but because it is so near and so obvious. And that is exactly how the supernatural has been forgotten. God is closer to us than we are to ourselves. And if you're C.S. Lewis, wanting to write a series of books which are about Christ, how would you get this aspect of Christ's nature into your story? It's easy enough to see how Lewis could get the discrete historical or temporal actions of Christ, you know, the act of creation, the act of redemption, the act of judgment, into a story. But how would you get the all-pervasive principle of cohesion into your story? We tend to think that Lewis is only interested in Christ as the incarnate Son of God, Jesus of Nazareth, who moved about the stage of the world 2,000 years ago, doing things to people, for people, with people. And of course, he was interested in that. But he was also interested in this. Not just the incarnate Son of God, but the eternal, infinite, omnipotent Son of God. God the Son, the divine Word, who created all things and who is sustaining all things. To communicate that imaginatively is a much harder thing to do, and yet it's equally part of Christian orthodoxy. Our knowledge of God is, in a sense, like looking along the beam. When you look along the beam vanishes. When you look along this Christ-drenched universe, it's very easy for Christ to vanish from it, because if he's in everything, in a sense, he might as well be in nothing, because you have no negative with which to contrast your positive experience. Lewis talks about people who are born near Niagara Falls. They're born hearing the sound of the water. It's filled their ears for every second of every minute of every hour of every day of their lives. And it's only when these people grow up and travel 10, 15 miles away so that they can no longer hear the sound of the water, that for the first time in their life, they hear the sound of the water. Because they now have the negative with which to contrast the positive experience. Until that point, they'd never stepped outside the beam. They'd only ever looked along it. Do fish find the water wet? Probably not, because they're aquatic animals. It's only amphibious creatures who know what wetness is, because they have dryness with which to contrast their experience of wetness. But we can't get outside this Christ-drenched universe, because all things hold together in Christ. We've never known a single moment of any other kind of universe. The supernatural can be overlooked because it's so obvious. So that's the theological background point. Now a more literary background point. Lewis once wrote an essay called The Kappa Element in Romance, and kappa is the initial letter of the Greek word krypton, which means cryptic or hidden. So the title of this essay means the hidden element in story. That's what romance means here. The hidden element in story. Lewis wrote an essay with that title. It should alert us to the possibility that there may be more going on in the Narnia books than meets the eye. The only thing is that Lewis never published this essay under that title during his lifetime. It only exists in note form. He later wrote it up and published it under a different title, On Stories. And in On Stories, Lewis says this: to be stories at all, Stories must be a series of events. But it must be understood that this series, the plot as we call it, is only really a net whereby to catch something else. The real theme may be, and perhaps usually is, something that has no sequence in it, something other than a process, and much more like a state or a quality. The best stories have this qualitative flavour or atmosphere to them, not just a rollicking good plot. If the plot is the only thing that matters in a story, you would never read a story more than once, because you know the plot. I mean, whoever reads an Agatha Christie more than once? You're only interested in the plot, aren't you? I am, at any rate. But certain novels you go back to dozens, scores of times, because you're not so much interested in what happens, you're interested in how it happens, the people to whom it happens, the way it happens, the whole world in which these sorts of happenings happen. You like breathing the oxygen of that imagined world. You just like being there, hanging out with those characters. That's the state or the quality of a well-written story. Lewis's example of a bad story is The Three Musketeers, which he says is terribly exciting, but has no weather to it. The characters go from London to Paris, and there's no sense that Paris is any different from London. In that book, you have a lot of little beams to look at, but no consistent beam to look along, no pervasive quality to the story which you can immerse yourself in. It's a little bit like what your experience when you go to the movies. You can always tell a bad movie, can't you? Because a bad movie, when you're watching it, the frame of the screen becomes visible to you. Yeah? When the movie is engrossing you, you, as it were, pass through the screen into the imagined world. You move about with the characters. And it's only when it loses your interest and you sink back in your chair that you suddenly remember, oh yeah, I'm in the cinema again. By the magic of a well-made film, a certain something becomes invisible to you. Of course, the screen is always there, but it becomes cryptic by the magic of good storytelling. And so in a sense, we have a similar thing with what Lewis is talking about here, the qualitative atmosphere of a well-told story. You're not looking at it as you read, you're looking along it. When you close the book and reflect upon it afterwards, you might look at it, but for as long as you're living the story, you don't notice it. So you see how here we have a literary equivalent of enjoyment consciousness. And now fifthly and finally, in our background reasons, a more historical background point. Lewis once wrote a review of the Oxford Book of Christian Verse, in which he talks about this technique that many Christian poets used up until the 17th century, which he calls transferred classicism. Transferred classicism is when writers took their knowledge of classical mythology and transferred it into their presentation of Christian themes. They would take their knowledge of the pagan deities, Zeus, Jupiter, Venus, and under the pagan veils, they would say something about the God of their believed religion, the God of Christianity. Paganism, Lewis says, is the religion of poetry up until the 17th century, through which the author can express at any moment just so much or so little of his real religion as his art requires. Transferred classicism is the best method, Lewis says, of writing poetry which is religious without being devotional. And everyone is in the secret. Where are we? Oh, yes. What Lewis is talking about, in a sense, has a precedent in what we find St. Paul doing in the Book of Acts. You remember how St. Paul, preaching to the men of Athens, says, God is not far from each one of us, for in him we live and move and have our being. As some of your own poets have said, for we are indeed his offspring. Who's Paul quoting there? Greek poets who wrote poems about Zeus. And if you look at the originals by Aratus and Epimenides, you find that it is in Zeus that we live and move and have our being. We are indeed Zeus's offspring. That's what Paul is quoting. And he's transferring from that classical knowledge of divinity into his presentation of the gospel so that his readers, his hearers can get a sort of inkling of what he's talking about. He's saying, yeah, you're right, we live and move and have our being in God. You're right that we're God's offspring. You're wrong in calling him Zeus. He is, in fact, the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. But you're right in these other respects. So he transfers classical mythology into his Christian presentation. That's not exactly what the medieval writers were doing, because they were writing for readers who were already Christian, or could be supposed to be Christian, but the principle is the same. You hide God, as it were, behind a pagan veil. God, Lewis says, often appears in medieval literature, but incognito. So those are our five background points. Lewis's temperamental capacity for secretiveness, his belief in enjoyment consciousness when the beam vanishes when you look along it, his belief in the overlookability of God by virtue of God's very omnipresence, the importance of a qualitative atmosphere in a well-told story, and then hiding God behind a pagan veil. So we're now back where we started, the Narnia Chronicles. How do these stories hold together, if they do? Are they just a hodgepodge, a random mishmash, or is there a more intelligent design? And at this point, it's worth remembering that although Lewis is best known for the Narnia Chronicles and other works like Mere Christianity, the Screwtape Letters, he wasn't professionally a writer of fiction, and he wasn't professionally a Christian apologist. Professionally, he was an academic who taught at Oxford for 30 years, finished his career at Cambridge. He was a fantastically learned and distinguished literary critic and literary historian. And the biggest book that he ever wrote was this, English Literature in the 16th Century, Excluding Drama. I think you will agree that is a snappy title. And it was part of this multi-volume series by many different authors called The Oxford History of English Literature, or Oh Hell, as Lewis called it. It took him 15 years to write this book. It's a massive doorstopper of 700 pages. And when Lewis published it in 1954, he wrote to a friend and said, I finally finished this big academic book I've been engaged in the last decade and a half. It was the top tune all that time. And all the other books I published during those years were just its little twiddly bits. Which means that Screwtape Letters, the broadcast talks which became Mere Christianity, the earlier Narnia books, The Great Divorce, The Abolition of Man, Perelandra, That Hideous Strength, all these marvelous works were, as far as Lewis was concerned, just the little twiddly bits on this massive intellectual enterprise. This was the top tune. This was the melody, if you like. And all the other books I just listed were like the little piccolo flourishes or the tings on the triangle. Now, how many of you here have read this book? Anybody? Not a soul. Not even you two down the front. Well, isn't that interesting? We all know the little twiddly bits. We don't know the main tune. Lewis's preoccupations, what Lewis was professionally interested in, what he was paid to think about and teach, was this kind of thing. And we can only properly understand Narnia if we come at C.S. Lewis, first and foremost, with a knowledge of what he was concerned about in this kind of work. And I would encourage you to read this book if ever you have the chance, because it's actually rather readable. It's even funny, believe it or not. And it opens with a long discussion of this chap, Nicholas Copernicus. And I needn't remind you how, in the middle of the 16th century, Copernicus revolutionized astronomy with his theory of the heliocentric, the sun-centered cosmos. Until Copernicus, everyone had believed that the Earth was the center of everything. The Earth was static and central, and it was revolved around by the heavens. And Lewis was interested in the Copernican Revolution because he wanted to see how it played out in the literature of that period. Copernicus is kind of a big deal. Because obviously the sort of cosmos that you believe yourself to be living in will have a major effect upon the sorts of stories you tell about yourself and your place in the universe. So this was a subject of great interest to C.S. Lewis, and he returned to it in his last academic book, The Discarded Image. The title of this book refers to the old cosmos, the pre-Copernican universe. That's the image that we've discarded. But Lewis wanted to retain it, or at least retain some sort of awareness of it, because how could we understand or enjoy the literature of the pre-Copernican period if we didn't understand the whole cosmological assumption that went with it? So three times in The Discarded Image, Lewis invites his readers to try to imagine, try to put themselves back into the mindset of a medieval person, where you would believe that the Earth is static and central. Three times in The Discarded Image, Lewis asks his readers to take a walk under the sky at night and look up into the sky, trying to forget that it's space. The word space didn't exist before the time of Copernicus. You wouldn't have looked up into space. You would have looked up into the heavens, a series of ranked concentric spheres rotating around Earth, each with its own planet. The first of them, the sphere of the Moon, then Mercury, then Venus, then the Sun. The Sun, remember, would have been regarded as a planet before the time of Copernicus. A planet is a wanderer. That's what the word literally means in Greek. These are the wandering stars that take their own unique paths across the sky, and all the other stars are fixed in their constellations. So above the Sun, you have Mars, then Jupiter, and finally in the seventh heaven, Saturn. And still today, you hear occasionally people saying, "Oh, I was in the seventh heaven of delight." Why is it delightful to be in the seventh heaven? Because up there, you're furthest away from Earth and all its trials and tribulations. Go a bit further, and you eventually come out into the very home of God. Home of God and all the elect. You leave the created order and enter God's home. And this was all accepted science until Copernicus. This is hard established fact. Just as our Einsteinian model of the cosmos is established fact. And Lewis wanted to remind his students and his readers of this old view of the cosmos so that they could understand the literature that was written while people believed in this view of the cosmos. We haven't discarded it in every possible respect. We still use these seven planets to give us the names of the days of the week, of course. It's slightly hidden from us in English because only three of the names of the days of the week clearly relate. Saturday, Sunday, and Monday are obviously connected to Saturn, the Sun, and the Moon. The other four planets are best thought about in terms of French. So we haven't discarded it in every respect, but Lewis wanted to retain it a bit more thoroughly than just the names of the days of the week. Here's an illustration from perhaps the greatest poem of the Middle Ages by Dante, the Divine Comedy. You remember how in the Divine Comedy, the pilgrim mounts up through the seven heavens in his ascent to God's throne. And this illustration shows you the seven planets in the order of the days of the week, the seven characters who were associated with the planets. So there on the left, you have the Sun in his burning fiery chariot. There we have the moon in her silvery gown with her crescent. Then Mars with his helmet and his chain mail, Mars associated with all things warlike. Then Mercury with wings on his heels, Mercury the messenger, swift of foot. Then Jupiter. Jupiter is the king, and you can see that in the picture because of the staff he's holding over his shoulder. That's the kingly rod, the scepter, showing Jupiter's sovereignty. Then we have Venus in her green gown. Venus is associated with love, creativity, fertility, sexuality. To venerate someone is to love them under Venus. To contract a venereal disease is to do something under Venus, which you probably shouldn't be doing. So there are traces of Venus's influence even in our language. And finally, on the right-hand corner, you see Saturn with his sickle, cutting people down. Saturn was associated with death and disaster. And Father Time, with his scythe and his hourglass, is based on earlier pictures of Saturn, Lewis says. It's not just Dante who uses this old scheme. Chaucer uses it too. And here's a page of notes I found in Lewis's own handwriting. This is from Lewis's Complete Chaucer, and he's making notes about Chaucer's Knight's Tale from the Canterbury Tales. And Lewis admired the way that Chaucer put the planetary characters into the Knight's Tale, not just as actors in the drama, but he says, weaving the influences into the plot, so that the climax of the Knight's Tale happens on a Tuesday. Martes, Mardi, Mars's day. How appropriate for a story about knights. So Lewis had this academic interest. He also had a personal interest in astronomy. He had a telescope on the balcony of his bedroom. He enjoyed visiting the local observatory. He would often point out unusual conjunctions of the planets to his correspondents and to his friends. An academic interest, a personal interest, and an imaginative interest. If you know Lewis's trilogy of interplanetary adventures, you'll know how he uses this planetary symbolism very explicitly in the course of these three books. The first book is set on Mars, a very medieval Mars. The second book, Perelandra, is set on Venus, very medieval Venus. And in the third book, the planetary characters actually come down to Earth to bring about the end of the story. Lewis calls them angels. So the symbolism in these three books is unmistakable. Why was Lewis so interested in it? Well, he said this: the characters of the planets, as conceived by medieval astrology, seem to me to have a permanent value as spiritual symbols, which is especially worthwhile in our own generation. Of Saturn, we know more than enough, but who does not need to be reminded of Jove? A couple of things to say about this quotation. First of all, don't be alarmed by the word astrology. A lot of people, when they hear Lewis use that word, think, isn't astrology unchristian, pagan, occult? How can C.S. Lewis, this great Christian writer, have been interested in astrology, for goodness sake? Well, it all depends what you mean by astrology. In biology, you study life. In geology, you study the earth. In anthropology, you study mankind. In astrology, you study the stars. Nothing necessarily wrong about studying an aspect of God's creation. It all depends what you do with it. If it leads you to worship the stars, it's wrong. If it leads you to consider the stars as controlling you, that's wrong. But no Christian theologian before the time of Copernicus denied that the stars had spiritual significance, Lewis says. After all, the heavens are telling the glory of God. Of course they have spiritual significance. There's a long tradition of Christian astrology. The finest warrant for it, I suppose, is Matthew's gospel. We have seen his star in the east, and we have come to worship him, the wise men say. The wise men were astrologers. They looked at the stars, they studied the significance, and it led them to Christ. So let's not be alarmed by the word astrology. There's a long and noble tradition of Christian astrology, and when Lewis uses the term, he's not talking about the nonsensical horoscopes in the back pages of magazines. He also says that these characters of the seven heavens have a permanent value as spiritual symbols. A permanent value. It's not just for the medievals. No, it's for us too. Indeed, he says they have a special relevance for his own generation. Why? Because his own generation knew more than enough about Saturn. Saturn with his sickle, cutting everybody down. Lewis's generation was, of course, the generation that went through the First World War. Lewis himself was a teenage officer in the Great War, was very nearly killed during the course of that conflict. 750,000 British servicemen were killed during the 1914-18 war. Of Saturn, of death and disaster, we know more than enough, Lewis says. And it was understandable that so much of the 1920s and 30s was characterized by what Lewis calls Saturnocentricity, a fixation upon Saturnine qualities of loss, pessimism, cynicism, and so on. All understandable and natural given the trauma of the Great War, but a historical accident as far as Lewis was concerned. A much better way of symbolizing the heart of spiritual reality was to be found in the symbolism not of Saturn, but of Jove, Jupiter, the king. So, you see where this is all going. The seven Chronicles of Narnia, I believe, are constructed out of these seven spiritual symbols. But this time, implicitly. Lewis had used the symbolism explicitly in the Interplanetary Trilogy. He uses it also very explicitly in a lot of his poetry. And he talks about it academically in so many of his scholarly works. Here in Narnia, he weaves the influences into the whole plot, like Chaucer had done. So that in each Narnia story, the governing planetary symbolism accounts for the way that Aslan is portrayed, accounts for the way the children interact with Aslan, and accounts for all sorts of ornamental and background details along the way. We don't have time to go into all seven books, but let's spend a little bit of time on the first three. So let's start with Jupiter. Who does not need to be reminded of Jove? There is the planet. And in the southeast corner there, you can just make out Jupiter's great red eye, the great spot of Jupiter. That's a storm perpetually raging on the surface of Jupiter. And the diameter of that eye, that spot, is greater than the diameter of Earth. You could fit the whole of our planet inside that little circle. Shows you how enormous Jupiter is. And then here we have Jupiter, the king of the gods. Zeus in Greek mythology. Now, I was reading a long poem that Lewis wrote about the planets when I was halfway through my PhD. It was 11:30 one night, one Wednesday in February. And when I got to the lines in this poem about Jupiter, I did a double take. I stopped. I was brought up short because Jupiter, according to this poem, brought about winter past and guilt forgiven. And those five words leapt off the page at me. Winter past and guilt forgiven. That's very like a five-word plot summary of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, I thought to myself. So I began to look more closely at the symbolism of Jupiter as expressed in the poem, and a great deal of the imagery in the poem seemed to link up with the imagery in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. Not just the passing of winter. You remember how the White Witch has made it always winter and never Christmas. not just the forgiving of guilt, Edmund's guilt is forgiven, but also that major theme of imagery running through the whole of the book, which has to do with kings and queens. Aslan is introduced as the king of the wood. That's the very first description we get of him. And we're later told that he's royal, that he's got a royal pavilion, a royal standard. His sovereignty, his kingship are continually emphasized. And not just his sovereignty either, but that also of the boys and girls, the four children from England. They are to become kings and queens. You remember how they first step into the wardrobe and they find those fur coats. They put them on and we're told the fur coats looked more like royal robes than coats when they put them on. And that's an indication of what's going to happen to the children. They're all going to become increasingly royal as they interact with the king of the wood. But not without a hiccup on the way. Edmund, you remember, is ensnared by the White Witch. And we always tend to recall the Turkish Delight. But the Turkish Delight is only the bait on the hook. What reels Edmund in is the prospect of becoming a king, so he can pay Peter back for being so beastly to him. I want a boy who will be prince and later on the king, the witch says to him. And all these thoughts about what he's going to do when he's king keep going through Edmund's mind. Peter, on the other hand, is taken by Aslan and he's shown the castle and the four thrones. And Aslan says to Peter, you will sit in one of these thrones. You will be high king over all the rest. Over all the rest. So Edmund does indeed become a rightful king by the end of the story. But only after Aslan's demonstrated true kingship in his sacrifice for Edmund's sake. Aslan dies on the stone table and comes back to life. Why so? Is that just a convenient way that Lewis can talk about the sacrifice of Christ on the cross? Has he just thrown it in as a little Sunday school lesson for his children readers? No, it's part and parcel of Lewis's understanding of Jupiter or jovial symbolism. Lewis said this about the poetry of his great friend Charles Williams. When Williams writes of Jupiter's red pierced planet, he assumes that the huge reddish spot that astronomers observe on the surface of Jupiter is a wound, and the redness is that of blood. Jupiter, the planet of kingship, thus wounded, becomes another ectype, another symbol, a reflection of the divine king wounded on Calvary. So this shows us that Lewis very explicitly connects the symbolism of Jupiter with the sacrifice of Christ, which of course he's reworking at the heart of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. The death and resurrection of Aslan isn't just a convenient Sunday school lesson. It's part and parcel of the jovial symbolism out of which the whole book is constructed. Here's a medieval woodcut showing you Jupiter enthroned in the heavens, and down on earth are the people who exhibit his influence. So there on the right you have a coronation scene. There in the left, in the middle ground, you see a man kneeling for judgment. Is his guilt going to be forgiven? And in the background you can just make out horses and hounds hunting a white stag, the white hart, which was the noblest quarry that kings and queens would hunt for in medieval stories. And all these episodes and elements Lewis has put into The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and many others besides, so that it has a jovial feel to it, a jovial flavour. And that's not just a literary technique. There's theological significance. The whole Narnia series is about Christ, Lewis says. And that means that the whole story is about Christ. It's not just when it's about Aslan that it's about Christ, because all things hold together in Christ. Transferred classicism, hiding God under a pagan veil, Lewis takes the symbolism of Jupiter, and under that pagan veil he presents Christian themes. The kingship, the passing of winter, the forgiving of guilt, and even the presence of Father Christmas, too, is part and parcel of it, but we don't have time to go into why that is so. Maybe in the Q&A. Very much more briefly now, the prevailing spirit, the Christological symbolism of Prince Caspian is Mars. Why? If you saw the recent film version, you'll have picked up on the military symbolism of the story. They really went to town on that in the book. Battles are everywhere in this story. Yes, but you might say there are battles in some of the other Narnia books too, so why aren't those martial? Well, think of what you see on the cover of the book here, those trees. Caspian's just about to be knocked off his horse by that falling tree. You remember how Lucy tries to wake the trees? The trees come to the battle at the end of the book. What's that got to do with Mars? I had no idea about this until I began my researches, but Mars wasn't always and only a god of war. He was also a god associated with trees and forests. He was known as Mars Silvanus. And this is a mural from Pompeii showing you Mars as god of war with his shield, his spear, his helmet. But he's standing against a backdrop of burgeoning vegetation. He was known as Mars Silvanus. And we still refer to this in the third month of the year. March is sacred to Mars in this capacity because the trees come back to life after winter in the month of March. So, in Prince Caspian, we have the military themes running throughout the book. Caspian fights and defeats the usurping King Miraz. But we also have the tree imagery. Aslan sums it all up in his own person. Aslan gives the great war cry, summoning everyone to the final battle. But he's also the one in whose presence the trees come alive. Lucy tries to wake the trees and can't unless Aslan's there too. Aslan is the true Mars. You might say he's the Lord of hosts, mighty in battle, if you are wanting to go straight to the scriptures. Just as under Jupiter, you might say Aslan is King of Kings and Lord of Lords. What Lewis is doing is a very scriptural thing. But he's taking his very scripturally orthodox understanding of Christ, and he's going a long, long journey round through classical mythology, medieval literature, and his own poetic intelligence to enrich and deepen the scriptural symbolism with all these associations. Fantastically sophisticated thing that he's up to. And in Prince Caspian, the boys harden into knights, and the girls romp in the bacchanalian revelry with the swaying trees and the growing vines. They themselves become martial as they respond to the martial Aslan. They grow up into his spirit. They breathe the atmosphere of that Mars-drenched universe. Just as we in the real world, if we're Christians, will grow up into Christ as we breathe this Christ-drenched universe. The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, much more briefly now, is the Sun Book, the solar story. You remember how Lucy sees Aslan flying in the sunbeam. When they meet Aslan at the eastern edge of the world, he scatters light from his mane. They come to a magic island with a pool that turns things to gold. Gold is the sun's metal. And they see Aslan on a hillside above that pool. And we're told that he's shining as if in bright sunlight, though the sun has in fact gone in. Sunlight imagery, gold imagery are everywhere in this story, as is the imagery of dragons. You see the dragon-shaped ship. You remember how Eustace is turned into a dragon and then undragoned. Is that just a convenient Sunday school lesson about Christian conversion? No, it's part and parcel of the total solar symbolism out of which the book is constructed. Because in Greek mythology, the sun god was Apollo, and Apollo was famously a slayer of dragons. If you know your Homer, you remember the hymn to Apollo, where Apollo slays the dragon Python, and he was known as Sauroctonus, the lizard slayer, the dragon slayer. And that's what Apollo is doing here. He's looking at that lizard, that miniature dragon, and he's killing it with beams from his eyes. And here's an illustration, a picture, a still from the recent film version of the Dawn Treader. This is Eustace's eyeball after he's been turned into a dragon. And you can just make out in the reflection in his eyeball the approaching figure of Aslan. Aslan is going to come and rip off the thick, dark, knobbly dragon hide and turn Eustace back into a boy again. Aslan is the true Apollo, the true sun god. And again, Lewis could have gone straight to John chapter 8. I am the light of the world, Christ says. But Lewis chooses, because of his literary sensitivity, his poetic skill, his historical knowledge, his mythological interests, to go that very long way round and come back to a scriptural conclusion. The silver chair is the moon book. The horse and his boy is the mercury book. And the magician's nephew is the Venus story. And the last battle, of course, is the Saturn book. Who is it who brings Narnia to an end in the last battle but Father Time? Father Time and Saturn are the same character, Lewis reminds us in the discarded image. And in an early draft of the Narnia books, Lewis had actually called Father Time the god Saturn. It's there in the draft. But Lewis evidently thought that was too obvious, that was giving the game away a bit too much. So by the time he came to publish, he calls the character Father Time and leaves out any reference to Saturn. So, that in hasty summary is how I believe Lewis used the seven heavens. The heavens are telling the glory of God. How are they telling the glory of God? Well, one way of answering that question is to look at the traditional associations which have built up over the millennia with the seven planets. So you can talk about Christ as the King of Kings, the Lord of Hosts, the Light of the World, and so on and so forth, across all seven. You can also, if you're a brilliant writer like C.S. Lewis, use the symbolism to portray Aslan, and the way the children interact with Aslan, and in all sorts of ornamental background details along the way. And why do you do that? Well, two main reasons. One, the literary reason, the kappa element in romance, the pervasive, qualitative atmosphere of a story. It's not just the plot, it's the whole weather of the story as well. That's the literary reason. And the theological reason we've touched on many a time throughout this last hour, that Christ is not just to be understood as the historical, singular, solitary historical figure of Jesus of Nazareth, not just that, but also the discarnate or the unincarnate God who holds all things in being. That's equally part of Christ's nature. So if this theory is correct, the Narnia Chronicles are not a hodgepodge. They're not a mishmash. They are minutely articulated, imaginative constructions. They look, on the surface, to be a hodgepodge. Just as in the real world, too. We can sometimes scarcely believe that there's any design when we see accidents happen and the innocent suffer and all sorts of inexplicable things. But as Lewis believed, the real world does indeed have an intelligent designer behind it. And he's going to try and model that himself in his own imaginative works. Down to the curve of every wave and the flight of every insect. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael, very much indeed. We're just going to have a short break, maybe 2 or 3 minutes, just to sort of stand and stretch. Don't go too far away. And if you've got a moment, just tweet in your questions or text them in. Now is a very good time to do so. And then for the last 25 minutes or so, we'll have some questions after the session. So very short break, and we'll start again in 2 or 3 minutes' time. Thanks. Okay. Well, we've got a whole series of questions that I'm going to read out, ask Michael the question, and then if you come and answer them, and then we'll do it that way. Great. So the first question, Michael, is it true that you were once in a James Bond film?
Yes. Yeah, I was in a James Bond movie, and I have C.S. Lewis to thank for that, indirectly. I live in Oxford, and back in 1993, Richard Attenborough came to Oxford to make the film Shadowlands about C.S. Lewis's late marriage with Anthony Hopkins, and so there was an opportunity to be an extra in that movie. I got a nice 1950s haircut and spent 4 days working on the Shadowlands. First time I'd ever been an extra. Because I'd been in that movie, my name then stayed on the books of this agency that supplied extras to filmmakers whenever they came back to Oxford or near Oxford. So one day I was rung up and said, the person on the other end of the line said, "Do you want to be in a movie next week?" "Yeah, okay. Well, what is it?" "It's the James Bond movie." "Oh, yes, I'll be in that." So I went to some studios in West London and was expecting to be in a large crowd scene, like you normally are as an extra. You normally don't even get to see the actors, let alone interact with them. But there were only 10 extras summoned to this studio. And of the 10 of us who were called, only 3 of us were taken onto the set. And the 3 of us who were taken onto the set, it happened to be me who was told, "Imagine you're mending these X-ray spectacles, and then allow them to be snatched out of your hand by Pierce Brosnan when he comes on." Okay. So I found myself interacting with 007 and Q and John Cleese. Having had no forewarning of that morning when I went in, it was one of the most remarkable moments of my life. And I asked myself, why have I been singled out for this? And I went back to the green room during the coffee break and I looked at the other 10 extras and I realized I was the only one who was bald with spectacles. That was the look they wanted, and I had the look and nobody else did, and it's the only time in my life that there's been a distinct advantage to losing my hair and going blind.
Very good. By the way, have we got a handheld mic at the back there? Do we have a handheld mic? It'd be great if we can have one. So, okay, another question. This theory about the planets and the Narnia stories, what did it feel like to discover that, and what convinced you that you had it right?
Thank you, yes. Well, on the day that it happened, I had had a meeting with my spiritual director. I used to go to this man once a term to receive spiritual advice and direction, and he's still alive. He's perhaps known to some of you. His name is Simon Barrington Ward. He used to be Bishop of Coventry. He used to be in charge of CMS. And he knew C.S. Lewis in the 1950s quite well. That was one of the reasons I was given him as my spiritual director. So I went and had a chat with Simon Barrington Ward and asked him about my work on C.S. Lewis, and I was wrestling with this question of wordless prayer. That's a theme that Lewis talks about a good deal in his book on prayer. He says wordless prayer is the best kind of prayer, when you don't verbalize the mental acts. And I was finding it difficult to understand what this meant and why it was important. So Simon Barrington Ward fished off the shelf a book about an Eastern Orthodox monk, as you do, and he read a passage from this biography all about this monk called Father Siloan. And to boil it all down very quickly, the question was, that this monk was asking was how do the perfect speak? How do the perfect speak? And the answer that Father Silouan came to in his wisdom and his godliness, because he's a very devout monk, was that the perfect never say anything of themselves. They only say what the Spirit suffers them to say. And as Simon Barrington Ward read this passage to me, it made a great impact on me. I'm not given to moments of great spiritual profundity or intensity, but this was one of them. There seemed to be a strange electric charge in the room as he said this. And I went back to my theological college in a bit of a daze, wondering what this all meant. And it was that very night that I was reading the Planets poem when the idea of Jupiter and the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe came to me. And I connect the two experiences. I think this discovery was put in my lap. It was a godsend. It was a gift. I didn't work it out through my clever intelligence. It just plopped into my lap. And what I was seeing, I think, was Lewis, in his own wisdom, giving us a literary equivalent of the Spirit speaking through human beings. The perfect never say anything except what the Spirit suffers them to say, so that the Holy Spirit takes up our prayers and verbalizes them, makes them articulate. The Spirit intercedes for us with groans too deep for words. That's what the monk is getting at. And here in the Narnia books, what Lewis has done, he's taken the spiritual symbols of the heavens and he allows them to speak through the story. They don't draw attention to themselves, but they're in every part of the imagined world. And so I very distinctly connect what Simon Barrington Ward showed me earlier that day with this discovery. And I think it was, for some odd reason, it fell to me to make this discovery. Someone was going to spot it at some point, but I'm so glad that it happened to me in the way that it did, because it reminded me that, you know, got nothing to do with my sort of cleverness in working it out. It was all just meant to happen. So that, in a nutshell, is how it came about.
And that, Michael, why do you think Lewis wrote these as children's stories rather than as adult grown-up novels?
Very good question. First of all, it's worth saying that fairy tales are not just for children. It was only when fairy tales became unfashionable in literary circles, Lewis says, that they gravitated to the nursery. But until the 18th century, 17th century, fairy tales were a universal genre. They were enjoyed as much by adults as by children. And still today, they are directed as much at adults as children. I mean, think of the great modern fairy tale tellers like, I don't know, Pixar movies or, you know, the early Disney movies. They're not just for children, are they? Adults and parents get just as much out of those, maybe more, than their children do, because they're able to put so much more in, they get so much more out. So a fairy tale is a universal genre, and that's one of the reasons I think Lewis was interested in writing them. From a more theological angle, fairy tales are like parables, aren't they? And how did Jesus teach? Mostly through parable, through telling stories about sowers going out to sow, about lost sons, about good Samaritans. Very easy stories to follow, and yet full of meaning, inexhaustible meaning. And I think Lewis is trying to imitate that example given us by Jesus at his own level, in his own way. I mean, obviously the Narnia books are a good deal more complicated than even the longest of the parables, but it's the same sort of principle. You can communicate so much more through story than you can through a systematic doctrinal presentation, because you're communicating to the imagination, not just to the intellect.
Thank you. Well, this one has got two parts to it, this question. The first part is,
Why do you think Lewis kept it hidden? What did he think to achieve by not telling anyone about this? The second half of the question is, if this was supposed to be hidden, have you now ruined for
us? Thank you.
That wasn't my question.
Why did he keep it hidden? Well, you might ask the same question, you know, to go back to the earlier point about the parables. Jesus says, doesn't he, to those outside, everything is hidden in parables. That seeing they may not see and hearing they may not hear. You know, it's the Socratic method of teaching, isn't it? You don't spoon feed your readers, your students, your audience. You give them the materials with which to learn. And if they want to learn, they will learn. Because they'll be mystified. They'll be interested. They'll be perplexed. They'll ferret it out. And if they're not interested, they won't. So it's a method, really, of separating the sheep from the goats, isn't it? It's the parabolic method of teaching is a kind of judgment upon the hearer. Do you care? Do you want to work this out? So that's a sort of educational, a pedagogical reason that, you know, it puts the onus onto to the reader. The teacher doesn't make it all easy. We don't learn best when we're spoon-fed. We learn best when we've had to do some legwork. And then you remember how I talked about looking along the beam. When you look along the beam vanishes. When you're steeped in the atmosphere of a story, you don't notice it because you're living it. Now, if Lewis is trying to achieve that sort of thing in the Narnia books with the planetary symbolism, then obviously he can't tell us what he's up to. Because that would be to shoot himself in his own foot. You know, you can't. It's like a magician working a trick and then showing you exactly how he did it. It takes all the magic out of it. He had to keep it secret. Even if he'd wanted to tell us, he couldn't, because that would have frustrated the very thing he's trying to achieve. And why is it important for him to achieve this? Because, well, all those reasons I just gave about parabolic teaching and working things out for yourself, but also because, I mean, what he's trying to encapsulate, I think, is this very mysterious aspect of our faith, that God exceeds our understanding. If we think we've got God taped, then we do not know God. Surely thou art a God who hidest thyself, says Isaiah. Now, how do you communicate that which is beyond our understanding? I think this is another reason that Lewis keeps it secret, that he's not wanting to tell us what he's up to, because what he's trying to represent is the spiritual reality of the real universe. God is bigger than our conception of God. Lewis says this in a number of places explicitly in his book about his wife's death. He says, "My idea of God is not a divine idea. And when it becomes divine, it becomes demonic. And then the true God in mercy shatters it. He's the great iconoclast. He will have no graven image, not even a mental graven image." We can't put God in a box. We can't define God. But God, by definition, is infinite. So it's that sort of the mysterious, the mystical aspect of our relationship with God, which I think, again, is one of the things that Lewis is trying to express.
Thank you. I suppose one of the authors more recently who's written a similar kind of fiction, but from a very different perspective, is Philip Pullman,
Many of you have read Philip Pullman's novels. And he's obviously been very critical of Lewis and the Narnia stories. And he criticises Lewis because he thinks that Lewis's vision is very kind of hostile to the physical world. And particularly he doesn't like the ending, does he?
Hmm.
Because in the Narnia stories, the children are killed in this train crash, and he thinks it's a kind of horrible ending to the story, that Lewis kills the children off. And why does he do that? So how would you respond to Pullman's critique of Lewis on those lines?
Thank you. That is a very good question. I was put up against Philip Pullman in a debate in Oxford a few years ago, and he's a very formidable debater. he rather wiped the floor with me, but I went away and thought about some of his arguments and realised that they don't really hold water. He doesn't actually know the Narnia books at all well. He thinks he does, and some of his criticisms are quite close to being accurate. But they just lack that 1% of the vitally necessary element that would make it an accurate critique. And if you want a fuller take on my attitude to Philip Pullman, I wrote a whole article about his claims, and you can find that on my website, michaelward.net. But to answer the question immediately, yes, the children are killed in a train crash. And Philip Pullman thinks this is a libel upon life. Death is better than life, according to C.S. Lewis. This is Pullman's reading. It's hard to understand how he can come to that conclusion, given that the children are resurrected. They go through death into a richer life on the other side of death. Lewis is not saying it's a good thing to be killed in a train crash or that death is the end of the story. Rather wisely and even rather daringly, Lewis is taking his readers through the stable door and out the other side. So I think the criticisms Philip Pullman has of Narnia are fundamental disagreements with Christianity. It's not that he dislikes Lewis or Lewis's storytelling, it's that he dislikes Christianity. And that, so it is, his criticisms of Narnia escape from the purely literary realm, and he confessed in the course of this debate with me that when he read Narnia, he first read Narnia as an adult. He said, I didn't read them when I was a child, and I read them at an age when I was beyond being beguiled by them, he said. Now that to me indicates that he's never really read the books, because part of the act of reading is to allow yourself to be beguiled. It's what Coleridge calls the willing suspension of disbelief. You have to set aside your preconceptions for the duration of the read in order to get what the author is giving you. When I read Philip Pullman's books, I try to enter into the mindset of an atheist. I temporarily, as it were, set aside my own Christian beliefs and try to see the world from Philip Pullman's point of view. That's what reading consists in. Imaginative sympathy, imaginative empathy. So for Pullman to say he wasn't willing to be beguiled by the Narnia books just indicates that it's a fundamental failure of the act of reading. Seriously.
If you could ask C.S. Lewis one question related to your theory, what would it be?
Well, I'd ask him, why is the horse and his boy set within the time frame of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe? That's perplexed me. I have no good answer to that question. I'm sure it's got something to do with how he understands the relationship between Mercury and Jupiter, but I've no understanding yet of what that is. But that's a rather nerdy answer to your question.
It's all right. I don't know what that is.
I think one question I might ask him is, because I think he did drop a couple of hints in places, and I'd like to check up on these hints. Someone wrote to Lewis and said, "I like your books, Mr. Lewis, and I fancy they could all be laid out to form a kind of literary cathedral." And Lewis wrote back to this man and said, "Oh, thank you, I like your idea of setting my books out as a form of literary cathedral. The books like Mere Christianity and Miracles, Problem of Pain, they are the cathedral school. And my Narnia books are the little side chapels, each with its own little altar." Now, I think that's a very interesting clue to what he was up to, that he's presenting Christ under seven different veils, seven different altars, as it were. So I would ask C.S. Lewis if that was indeed what he meant. I think that's probably what he meant, but it's only an intuition.
Okay, one last question for your time. What, at the end of the day, do we learn about apologetics from C.S. Lewis, particularly when we think about how we commend the Christian faith to our friends who don't share it? Are there particular things we can learn from Lewis and the way he went about it that can inform and shape the way we do apologetics today?
Well, yes, there are many ways in which we can learn from Lewis. Just briefly to mention three. In his writings, Lewis uses two broad methods of apologetic, the more rational and the more imaginative. And obviously the more rational kind are Mere Christianity and the Problem of Pain and Miracles and the Four Loves, the Abolition of Man, even to a certain extent, where he's arguing, he's philosophizing, he's building a case, he's defeating objections. He's giving you good reasons, solid reasons, and a logical case. And that's a very necessary part of apologetics. But the interesting thing about Lewis is that he's not just that kind of apologist. He's also the imaginative and more poetic kind who writes stories. And not just the Narnia books, but the Ransom trilogy, The Great Divorce, Till We Have Faces. Many of his poems are apologetic in a certain fashion. And in that kind of literature, Lewis can present Christianity as it feels, as it is lived by the imagined characters. He can put you into a drama. He can give you character and all those qualitative aspects of a well-told story which would never find a place in a systematic argument, but which are equally part of the Christian life. I think I would say they're probably a good deal larger part of the Christian life than argument. So that's one of the ways in which Lewis is so valuable as an example, that he gives you both. And then the third way in which Lewis is a great apologist, I think, is in the way he lived his life. He was a very devout Christian. He walked the talk. He didn't just write all these brilliant books, but he was a devout man who gave away most of his money, who took endless pains corresponding with people who wrote to him from all over the world, and many other, you know, noble, honourable, Christian-like things that you can point to that he did in the course of his life. He wasn't perfect. He had plenty of errors, and he had clay feet like the rest of us, but he was a thoroughly converted man. Walter Hooper, who knows more about Lewis than anybody, says that when he met Lewis, Lewis struck him as the most thoroughly converted man he'd ever met. And Lewis was himself alive to the fact that actually how we act, what we do, means much more to our non-Christian friends than what we say. If you want to preach a good sermon, live a good life. If you want to write a good work of apologetics, live a good life. Think of what St. Francis says, you know, preach the word at all times, if necessary, use words. Now, Lewis was fantastically gifted with words, but he also knew the limitations of words. And we don't need to be brainy. We don't need to be brilliant poets and dramatists to be successful apologists. We just need to live faithful Christian lives. And so I think Lewis gives us that too.
you very much indeed for coming tonight. You've given us a fascinating insight into this really quite extraordinary man. I guess Lewis is probably one of the most important and influential Christians in the whole of the last century, and has brought many, many people to faith through his works. And those Narnia stories, as we know, we've all read them. Most of us have read them. And it's been fascinating just to see that pattern. And I guess many of us will go back to the stories now and read them again and look for that pattern that you've revealed to us. So, Michael, we're really grateful to you for coming tonight. Thank you very much indeed. Shall we give a round of applause?